them/PrisonPipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Special thanks to our guest and Prison Pipeline Collective member Karen James for post-production. Free them all.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammack and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about shows and festivals coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to archive shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm. and also via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7, right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the free music archive.
An interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/kboo.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
KBOO.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroot News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Mass shooting in a small Mississippi town. The alleged gunman shooting six people dead in three different locations.
A Madison County mother who was an advocate for domestic violence victims is dead. The woman's ex-boyfriend is charged with killing her and shooting a man on Thanksgiving
Day. Today is the 150th day of 2023. So far this year, there have been 263 mass shootings reported in the United States. 327 victims have been killed in those incidents. Both those figures are the highest ever recorded this early in a year. Just over Memorial Day weekend, there were more than 20 reported mass shootings. Those resulted in the deaths of at least 16 victims and injured more than 90.
2023 is the worst year for mass shootings in America for at least a decade. More incidents, more injuries, and more deaths. A mass shooting is one where four or more people are killed or injured. 10 years ago, there were 90 mass shootings in the first 5 months of the year. So far this year, 263. So why is this happening?
You're listening to LTAR, Let's Talk About Race. Today, we revisit our show called Gun Violence, As American as Cherry Pie. This show first aired in March of 2023, and since then, hundreds of lives have been lost in the United States to gun violence. As of recording, the most recent mass shooting event to make national headlines was in Maine, where the shooter purchased his weapons legally. It's as true as ever in the United States, gun violence is as American as cherry pie.
In terms of impact, carnage, suffering, and inhumanity, I think there's nothing different about it. In terms of what political will might say is possible, appropriate, and needed to be done, I don't think there's anything different than when we first recorded this show. What I do think is different is some data that came out just today that analyzed state by state where states have taken action to limit the easy access to specific types of firearms, their deaths by firearms significantly dropped. In states where they did nothing or did less strategic action to limit access to these types of firearms that are being used predominantly in these killings, their gun deaths continue to go up. And what's interesting about this is the data also showed that because of actions at the federal government level with the Supreme Court and other actions that have tried to limit states' rights to put some barriers on this just wildly accessible weapons to everyone, that they are starting to see a backtracking of the reduction in gun violence deaths, and that those places where they had some of their laws overturned are now seeing an increased rise in those gun deaths. So what I think is different now is that we actually have data that shows both when we take common sense action that does have a direct correlation to reducing the number of gun violence deaths, what I think many people think is an intractable, impossible to touch situation. And not only do we have that evidence now, we have evidence that when we go backwards on some of this legislation to limit access to guns, the deaths go up. Now, do I think that's going to be credible inspiring to the common, to our culture, to our society, to take different action? I don't think so. In my least hopeful moments. On the other hand, every piece of information that shows us a different way, every piece of information that says this could be different, every piece of information that says human beings can and should take action to better the conditions of ourselves and those around there is another forward step. So that's what I think is different right now, is there is a lot more data and available information. And the last thing I will say is it's very rich to me that many social conservatives, the religious right, white nationalists have, pounded the streets around states' rights. States' rights, overreach of the federal government, states' rights, states' rights. And what you see is the actual lie that's being told by them in the narrative of what they're about and the independence and all of those kinds of things, because they're quite happy for the federal government to overreach all over the place, reproductive rights, affirmative action, et cetera, and on this issue of easy access to guns, they are happy for the federal government to overreach all over the place as long as it aligns with their political analysis and position.
Professor Johnson, you're down there in the South. Y'all love your guns, don't you?
Yes, they do. guns are good in church, they're good at school. So this is a gun-toting state. Your question was, do I think anything has changed? No, I don't. Do I see any, I guess, major action being taken? No, I don't. But I do have just a little bit of hope that comes from this last horrible mass shooting in Maine. I believe the numbers were just 18 people killed, 13 wounded. That is horrific. The glimmer of hope I saw in reading about that case was the fact that the family had alerted the police to a potential problem with the suspect. There has been more discussion about mental health and how this is, how this is impacting these mass shootings, the fact that we are not handling mental health very well. That little glimmer is the fact that we actually had a family that recognized it. Unfortunately, the results didn't, ended terribly, but we weren't even having that discussion before. So I think that there is a little awareness raising that's happening. So that gives me some hope that we'll start making some efforts in that direction. Also, I did see Vice President Kamala Harris on 60 Minutes. And when she talked about the agenda and what was important and top of the list, working on gun control was one of the items that she discussed, and specifically doing something about assault weapons. It's good to know that at least there is going to be a focus on that going forward.
This is LTAR, Let's Talk About Race. We're revisiting our show called Gun Violence, As American as Cherry Pie. In Oregon, in October, a plot for a mass shooting was foiled, and the would-be gunman was arrested. The guns he purchased to kill participants at a rock climbing festival were bought legally. His ex-wife had a restraining order out against him. Police were tipped off by acquaintances who believed that he could become violent. These factors together resulted in a mass shooting being averted. Preventing this violence is far rarer than it should be. Let's get back to the panel.
Whenever there's a mass shooting or whenever there is terrible activity or terrible crime, we often see commentators come and pontificate about why this has happened, whether it's social, what's wrong with our society, what's wrong with our education system, what's wrong with our families. And among the common threads, I think, of perpetrators is that they all have access to guns. Simple, if violence did not begin with guns and will not end with the elimination of guns. But I think, what's common among the common thread we see is at least access to guns, whether it is, someone who had training in the military or whether it's someone who had access to their parents' locked up gun closet. Whether it is someone who was able to go into the corner gun store and buy a gun, or someone who had access from a friend or stole a gun. What is common is the numbers of guns in our society. In the United States, where there are more guns than there are individuals, I think that is a problem, and that we must recognize that our society is not so unique than other society, and that the level of gun violence is so much higher in this nation than in just about any other nation. So we have to say, what is wrong with our nation that we have access to so many guns? And, certainly, as I noted, that guns and violence is part of our nation's history, and is part of our, some might say, our DNA, but I think it's also the possibility that we can resist that, and we do not have to say, well, it has always been, and so it will always be. For me, it's interesting to look at nations such as Australia and New Zealand, who had, although different, somewhat similar history in terms of frontiers and the introduction of Europeans into their society and the worship of guns. If those societies were able to overcome their reverence of guns and move in another direction, I think it may be possible. It will take lots of work. It will take years. I think it's possible to move away from bowing down before the altar of guns and guns violence, and to find another way to seek solutions to problems, and to find ways in which to remedy, and to find ways in which we can solve problems.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
We're talking about gun violence, gun control, and really where this issue strays from a conversation that we are able to confront. So with our panelists here today, first I want to ask, what are the underpinnings of the gun violence epidemic in America? Mary, your thoughts.
What would this feeling of complete inadequacy to have any impact, or to be able to understand enough to be able to have impact? And I think we've got to fight against that as hard as we can, because it plays into the dynamic of we cannot know, we cannot understand, thus we can do nothing. And in the face, in the vacuum of doing nothing, these kind of horrific acts of violence continue to move forward. And I feel almost like it doesn't, as you said, the research is very sketchy, if it exists at all. It's very inconclusive, if it exists at all. And yet, I can't help but think common sense might drive us or show us a pathway towards some type of action. And I am a person who believes that even incrementalism has its role, has its moment. And if we could just make things a little bit better, maybe it's not the universal panacea, but if we could just make things a little less worse, harm reduction, could we practice our harm reduction in this movement? I want to talk about the underpinnings of this epidemic and go way, way back. And I want to go back and say that I believe this epidemic started with the theft of the land from indigenous people, and the theft from the land of its resources and attributes from the enslavement of Africans. State-sanctioned enforcement of these two economic realities through the use of violence represented by guns. And if we can understand who had them, who did not, who got to use them, who did not, the origins of police as the vigilante groups to return enslaved people to the enslavers. That, I think, is the origins of this. And it is over these, the years of this country has been co-opted into a white supremacy culture that uses this agenda against Black and Indigenous people of color, women. Dr. Johnson was talking about domestic violence, the others, and of which we all are, to use this violence as the means by which we suppress. And I'm going to even say, I think there is pieces of this, when we think about the inability to be able to find common ground, the complete divide between, you know, what one piece of this conversation says is okay and what the other piece of the conversation says is okay, I want to harken back to the Great Replacement Theory. So this understanding that somehow white people in particular must defend themselves and their women, let's go back to misogyny, against, you know, the great hordes of people of color. And we've talked a lot on this show about the Great Replacement Theory, the moment when, and it's here in many places, Monterey Park, for instance, where the most recent murder killings happened. It's here in many places when the minority becomes the majority. And that day is hurtling along for some white folks. And the fear and the fear-mongering and the use of state-sanctioned violence and the tools of state-sanctioned violence to enforce or to oppress people of color in this moment, I think are all part of this gun epidemic.
I agree that it's a difficult and complex question, and I would echo what's been said here. The thing that comes to mind for me, thinking about the underpinnings of gun violence, and like Mary said, I'm also, you know, maybe more interested in half measures than I normally am. What are the actual concrete steps that we can take? Because to truly look at the issue is to be overwhelmed. To understand it is to be bombarded with the enormity of it all, right? But the first word in gun violence is gun. That has to be a big part of it. And we are in a unique society that wants to waffle on that topic. In 23 states, I believe, brass knuckles are banned. We can ban weapons. That's allowed. Switchblades, a lot of places are banned. You know, you can't go into a sporting arena with certain things on your person. It is not unreasonable that living in a society, there are certain things we're not going to do so that we can all get along, right? And I think the underpinnings of gun violence are, of course, what my fellow panelists have pointed out. This legacy of white supremacist, male-dominated violence that has been enacted towards all peoples in our society, and including to other white men. A lot of victims of gun violence are white men. A lot of perpetrators of gun violence are white men. The guns play a big part in it. They're very, very lethal when we talk about this stuff. So I think understanding the root psychology of where all of this comes from, what is the power fantasy that people want to engage with, when is it a defensive mechanism, when people are looking at a world that is something that scares them for whatever reason. Mary brought up some good reasons that people may find themselves to feel the need to be able to enact this kind of violence, because it is a particular kind of violence. It's not bar fight violence. It's not punching a punching bag in your basement kind of violence. It is specifically enacted on other people because it's a level of impunity. And I think the underpinnings of it's obviously a difficult question to answer, one that has many answers. But I don't think that should stop us from trying to answer it, stop us from having all of the conversations about different aspects of it. I've certainly seen that mental health has become a larger aspect of, especially talking about mass shootings and people who've become alienated and enact this kind of violence. But I don't think that the conversation should end there. And it's certainly not a coincidence. We spoke about how some of the studies on the issue are not incredibly fleshed out or conclusive, but you can look at other developed nations in the world and compare the number of gun deaths, and there's a big disparity there. Even if you want to go per capita, they do not have the access to guns that Americans have. And what has the access to guns gotten us, aside from living in terror, right? So I think that ought to be part of the conversation as well, and that maybe the Second Amendment is something, I know folks talk a lot about it being misinterpreted, but maybe it should be reinterpreted altogether. Maybe the Second Amendment isn't feasible in today's day and age. those are some of my thoughts. I want to move on to my next question here. When we're talking about gun violence, and specifically with mass shooting events, which Professor Johnson defined as three or four victims, what are the common threads between perpetrators of these kinds of violence? What can we take from that? Let's start with Mary and go from there.
Well, I have a pretty simple question. I mean, it's a pretty simple answer to this question. The common thread, and Althea, you just spoke to this, is gender in terms of between perpetrators, between and among perpetrators. Men are by far and away the ones who are utilizing this tool called a gun in these mass shootings. I think when we understand or look at the statistics for suicide and for accidental shooting and the shooting of children, that dynamic changes a little bit. However, when we are talking about these mass events, we're talking about men, and we're talking predominantly, I'm going to say it, white men. The common thread, that's not exclusive, I'm very much aware of that. The common threads are what we were just talking about in the last question, which is economics and racism and white supremacy culture. And I want to be super clear that my vision of freedom and equity and equality for women, for people of color, for all sorts of different folks is not that we can get to take up the tools of the oppressor and use them against ourselves. That is not my idea of liberty. That is not my idea of freedom. That is not my idea of having arrived in terms of full access to and benefit from the benefits of the society and culture. It's a pretty simple through line for me. It's based in gender. It's based in misogyny. It's based in racism. And in the end, it's based in economics. And once we understand that, I hope it becomes easier to see where we might take, as you say, Althea, half measures to try to address some of what we're seeing here and hopefully prevent.
Professor Johnson.
If I look for commonality, I agree with what Mary Lee said, and I would add age, because the age is around 34, which is interesting to me because this should be the most productive time, you would think, in terms of how we advance through life here. And it is also, I think, the fact that they're male, 47% white, 1/3 black, according to the Washington Post article that I read, and the rest, you know, from other demographics. And the other thing that it's happened is as a result of this violence and the proliferation of guns because of our inability to legislate properly, we're actually magnifying the problem. Because I was reading now that there is a rise in the purchase of guns by Black people by 58% in 2020 as a reaction to being targeted in that mass shooting, and also, you know, some of the police violence that's been experienced. So now what we've done is that we've taken this gun culture and expanded it to a group of people that may not have been inclined to even own guns, but feel that for safety, because we equate guns and safety, they feel a need to have them and to have them in their home. Even though statistics show that they're really not a measure of safety. In fact, they probably work against most people who have guns in the home. So it is interesting to look at when we try to look at commonality of what may be driving people. The other thing, if I step away from it, is also part of what Mary Lee was talking about. We have a gun culture in this country, and it's supported by the NRA has done an amazing job of making, you know, of reinforcing gun ownership, and it has become a way of problem solving, and almost an acceptable way of problem solving. And when we see laws like Stand Your Ground and how that resulted, you know, in the Zimmerman case, it's just, we have built a culture and a legal system that really supports guns and the use of guns. And that's a big paradigm shift, but it's something that I think you're right. If we narrow it down to more bite-sized pieces, we can start to move this in a different direction.
I think your analysis of what these perpetrators have in common is very apt and accurate. I would expand on what was mentioned about white supremacy culture and the ways that that manifests, especially in the American context. The privileging of the individual above all else, I think, is an important aspect to highlight as a part of this, that there is not support for the good of all. There is a certain, I want to say valorization, that's the word that comes to mind, of the individual's right to do whatever the heck they dang well please. And even if you don't like it, well, that's part of why it's good, is because I get to do things that people don't like. And that's special and good. And if we take 2 seconds to start to break that down, everything starts to fall apart. And many, many aspects of American culture can be attributed to that kind of thing. Another thing that I think plays in is death anxiety. Seeing this, like Professor Johnson mentioned, continue to happen around the country with how helpless people become, that motivates more death anxiety. And what is death aside from, what is death representative of if we can't conceptualize it as the non-existence of our physical person? What is your spiritual death based on what you believe? And I think that motivates people in a lot of ways too. There's a study about this. I can find the exact one, but how it motivates people, that one's own views about death influence how you feel about the death penalty, influence how you feel about what does it mean to deserve to die. And to put that power into somebody's hands with ease of use, with the availability of guns, I think is something that we need to analyze. And what are we trying to protect when we are giving into this kind of death anxiety? The other thing that I would highlight, especially as it comes to misogyny and the ways that men in particular enact this kind of violence, there was what I thought at the time was a kind of out there satire of the gun violence issue on a Netflix show called BoJack Horseman. And on this show, in their fiction, it was not until American women en masse started carrying handguns that sensible gun reform was passed in the United States. And when that came out, this was a couple years ago, gun violence was still bad at that point. But that was, oh, what a silly satire. It's and the punchline is, which does America hate women more than it loves guns? And the answer in that program was yes. But increasingly, we find ourselves in situations where satire doesn't feel like it goes far enough, or real life seems like it would be satirical if you told it to someone 2 years ago. But I think we can't ignore the ways that there are these connections between perpetrators, the way that there are connections between what motivate people to do this, and how can we intervene on that? And why are some of those possible interventions supposedly out of the question?
This is LTAR, Let's Talk About Race. We're revisiting our show called Gun Violence, As American as Cherry Pie. In Oregon, in October, a plot for a mass shooting was foiled, and the would-be gunman was arrested. The guns he purchased to kill participants at a rock climbing festival were bought legally. His ex-wife had a restraining order out against him. Police were tipped off by acquaintances who believed that he could become violent. These factors together resulted in a mass shooting being averted. Preventing this violence is far rarer than it should be. Let's get back to the panel.
I think it's important, as you just stated, to recognize the role of race and racial resentment play in this gun violence epidemic. It is true that it's been the history of this nation that Black people and brown people and people of color have been terrorized by violence and gun violence. And that whether it is by the official police or whether it is by citizens or communities, all communities have been threatened by violence, by gun violence. The horror of children and women and men being the recipients of violence is so long and so deep that, again, it seems as if we will never get beyond it. But first, we need to recognize that our communities have been terrorized by violence. So where do we go from there? How do we get beyond that? I think, you know, beyond trying to find ways in which we can come together and learn from one another, I think we have to look at our system. What is it about our society which continue to demonize, create images or monsters that create ways in which people are afraid of this mythical, and you can fill in the blank, Black or brown person? That is so deep in our society. So I think one thing we can do, again, is to just be honest with ourselves and say, there's something about our society which has threatened, which feel threatened by, Black people. And they feel as if it is okay and their right to shoot down Black people. You know, how do we get beyond that? I think, how do we resist that? I'm not sure. I'm not ready to. Communities that have been terrorized to pick up guns to defend themselves. But I think we must at least first recognize that the violence that we have been the recipients of and the need to seek other ways. So I'll conclude by saying, I don't know.
I want to follow on with Professor Johnson's response. And I want to say, we all as humans are able to experience rage and depression and grief and have challenges with our mental health, all the feels. That is not, from my perspective, what's wrong with this situation. What is going wrong in this situation is that when we have all these feels, we have way too easy access to guns that have such an incredible lethality to them. So again, this common sense piece of, you know, that old tried thing, like guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, people have those feelings. I can completely agree with that. We all experiencing these ups and downs of life. However, when certain individuals have these feelings, they have way too easy access to guns, and guns are so lethal. So, okay, that was following on with Professor Johnson. I'm not sure this quote has much impact for me, right? And we've talked about how there isn't a lot of research. We've talked about how the research that is there isn't very compelling. I want to come back to something we've talked about a lot over our conversations, which is, where is there a place of agreement rather than where do we most vociferously disagree with each other? And I think this is nowhere more critical than in this conversation about guns. As I said before, I'm not clear about what should be done nor what can be done. However, giving into despair that leading to inaction is something that I am quite clear we all cannot do. So even with the uneven results and the data that's lacking, and I'm not a big person who's into data, the RAND gun policy in America did some studying and talking to folks, and they pulled together a group of individuals who were at opposite ends of this discussion. So people who were members of the NRA and people who were members of the Brady Group against handguns and folks, you know, really diametrically opposed. And they found four policy approaches that might both sides agree could be reasonable approaches, something to do. Those four things were state prosecution of people who are prohibited from seeking and owning firearms, expanded mental health prohibitions for people who can access firearms, the surrender of firearms by people who have been assessed to be prohibited to possess them, right? And prohibitions for firearms for individuals who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders. Those four policy actions don't seem, you know, it's not like someone's going to say, oh, these are the best things ever. However, they are a very rare place, according to this research, that says that people from both perspectives and in between might find some commonality towards. I think we should be pushing that for ourselves and for our strategies. RAND also goes on to say that even a 1% reduction in homicides from guns nationally would be approximately 2,500 fewer deaths over a 10-year period of time. I'm willing to take incrementalism in this moment and think that there would be 2,500 fewer deaths as a result of guns. The other thing I think about is when we look at this issue through an economic lens, I'm really interested and very ignorant about gun owner insurance. I think strategies that that are targeted to looking at economic impact rather than moral impact, or even, you know, things that want to, you know, reify the family or children. I think looking at strategies that have an economic basis and an economic impact is a stronger potential pathway to pursue than trying to push some of the other ways that we've talked about this as prevention or preventative.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Ediplay International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Listening to the news is experiencing one trauma dump after another. Therefore, at Let's Talk About Race, we created a new segment to inspire. This segment is entitled, Hope is a Thing with Feathers.
For my Hope is a Thing with Feathers, the thing that is giving me hope in these recent days is the end of the UAW strike. United Auto Workers have come to agreement with the Big Three and are putting an end to this over a month-long strike that they've been on. And it's incredibly impressive when you see what they've gained and you compare it to some of the predominant media narratives about what the impact of this would be. Major media publications were saying that this could tank the economy, say goodbye to the Midwest, things like that. Or cars are going to be more expensive. Ah, freak out. That's not really what ended up happening. And so often in strike narratives and when we're talking about labor unions and their actions, they're often asking for pittance, very, very little. We just want 2%. We just want 1% of a raise. We just want a cost of living adjustment. We just want to have health care. And that's not what the UAW was fighting for. They were fighting for a 40% raise over 4 years. That's a big number. That is a far bigger number It changes the justification from, well, can't you give people enough, workers enough to live off of, to can't you give people enough to live well off of? Even with those headlines, still they prevailed. Still they won. And still the public perception of them or the public pressure didn't end up flipping against the workers. They made their case compellingly and they innovated in terms of strike strategy, making something that the big three automakers couldn't handle. And it gives me hope. It gives me hope that people didn't fall for this narrative, that there are changes in the way that labor organizing is being perceived. And as the average person, it's far clearer that one's interests align more so with workers than hand-wringing about potential profit cuts to these automakers that were tripling and quadrupling their profits during the pandemic, partially thanks to concessions that workers made during 2008 when the auto industry was in big trouble. So that gives me hope. And I know that there are a lot of other strike actions taking place around the country and that workers are seeing a lot more support in their communities.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things. Talk about things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Previously on LTAR, Let's Talk About Race.
The Pill of Death, the Fentanyl Crisis in America. On this edition, we are examining the drug crisis in America, primarily fentanyl and opioids.
This war on drugs was often a war on Black people. We can fast forward and see how it's connected to the incarceration rate, the prison industrial complex, and the continued assault on the Black community. This assault, which was seen as an attack on drugs, was indeed an attack on the Black community.
The so-called drug war led to the criminalization of people of color, particularly young Black people, in the late 1980s and 1990s. Individually, family wealth was eroded, communities became war zones, and Black-on-Black crime escalated. And now the drug crisis has spread to wider cities and towns, and all of America is experiencing what the Black community suffered, or are they?
Fast forward to 2023 and this so-called third raid of the opioid crisis. A lot of it has focused on the impact on white community. This may be a good thing in that it will shift the focus from pursuing people and arresting people and maybe put the emphasis on healing and health and the possibility of people being restored to healthier conditions.
I just read a quote this evening from John Ehrlichman, who was an aide to Richard Nixon, who said it never was meant to be a war on drugs. And this is a quote: "We knew we couldn't make it legal to be either against the war or Black, but getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and Blacks with heroin, then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities," end quote. From the very beginning, this whole concept of war on drugs, which they also connected with the high crime rates they were experiencing during this time, it never was a war on drugs. It was the destruction of these communities so that they could advance their own agenda in terms of the war in Vietnam and also a war on Black people.
the criminalization of drugs, the Schedule Ones as we know them today, coincide with waves of immigration in the United States. So, for example, marijuana wasn't criminalized until there were Mexican immigrants in the United States. Opiates weren't criminalized until there was an influx of Chinese immigrants in the early 1900s, and so on and so forth. For pretty much any community that you can think of, this is the history that we see, and it's a means of stoking xenophobia, racism, classism, and it doesn't result in less people doing drugs, which I think is also worth noting here. And what we're looking at now is a little bit different in its own way, because we are talking about what was formerly considered a white issue.
From 2010 to 2019, rates of opioid-related mortality in Pennsylvania had an increase of nearly 475%. Being a resident that's lived here, I've seen the evolution of it. And just historically, it has, when you watch TV, it's like a suburban or rural drug problem. Right? It's young people, they get a hold of their parents' drugs, or they are a blue-collar worker, they hurt themselves, they're prescribed opiates, they become addicted. So the narrative on the white opioid drug user, as opposed in comparison to the African-American crack user, is that the person who is using crack had a character flaw. Right? You know, there's something wrong with them. They live in the hood, so they're expected to use drugs. But no, not Mikey, right? Who's from Ohio, and he wouldn't be involved in this.
We saw a white face on the fentanyl epidemic from about 2012 to 2015. And then after that, the demographic shift. And then you start to see that more Black people are also ODing on these drugs. And they're ODing at a very important time in their life. But now this is really negatively impacting the Black community. You're seeing that the treatment, the access to drugs that can help, is not available in the Black community. And also because the access to healthcare for communities of color is very different, what they have available in their communities. So I was really happy to read that there's some effort now, even in the private sector, to be able to open facilities in the communities that will reach out to these groups of people and provide that treatment, drugs for treatment, as well as counseling. The demographics are really changing, and it is becoming a significant problem for Black people, also Hispanics, in terms of the results. The other thing that's happened is that there is a broader understanding of the need to decriminalize drugs.
This means that access to health care is important if we are going to really treat this problem, not as a criminal problem, but as a health problem. So we have to make sure that access is expanded to communities, poor communities that are limited, and that people have the ability to get the treatment that they need. I think it is good that there is a move away from the criminalization of drugs to seeing it, the problem, as a health crisis. The challenge is, when and will we be able to put the resources needed to make sure that all those who are suffering have access to good treatment, good care, and are able to live a full and healthy life?
There's the push and pull, right? There is progress in one direction of considering it a healthcare issue, not something that is necessarily totally outside of one person's control, but not something that can necessarily be taken on and addressed solo with enough conviction of will for every person. And people don't deserve to die. That shouldn't be a controversial statement. But I think that there is this pushback to it, especially when it comes to putting our tax dollars to work to try to keep people from dying overdose deaths.
Decriminalization isn't the total answer. You can't have decriminalization and not have the support in place for people. And I know that Oregon, as a part of exploring decriminalization of drugs and the decisions that were made, there are other places that have done it successfully, but the difference was they had health care.
I think for me, when I think about harm reduction, the first thing is centering the idea that the most important thing is that people don't die. That's the main goal. And with fentanyl and opioids in particular, there are some good strategies to tackle that. And that's why this sort of third wave opioid crisis with the xylazine animal tranquilizer that doesn't have a reversal or any kind of antidote is really scary. But for opioids, there is such a thing as Narcan. There is naloxone, the overdose reversal drug. Let's think about it. It could be as widespread as the Heimlich or as CPR. It could be that every store on the block has Narcan and naloxone in their first aid kit in order to be able to support in this way. That could be something that we tackle as we're thinking about moving away from an addict as a moral framework, as something that somebody should not be morally. There are a lot of structures around drug addiction and drug treatment that are built on the fact that people are treated as morally bad. There are a lot of limitations, there's no trust, and it asks a lot of people. For example, methadone users, people who are trying to get off meth, there's a lot of restrictions and punishments and ways that, you know, the average person, if these kinds of restrictions were put on them, it would make life feel utterly unmanageable. But that is what is asked of folks who are addicted to a substance.
The harm reduction model works because I think it takes people from where they are and saying, this is where you are. How do we get to point B? There is, as others have stated, no one size fit all. And the harm reduction theories and harm reduction ways of addressing this crisis is a compassionate way in which we allow people to get the help they need where they need it and when they need it. It might seem odd and difficult for people, but for those who are impacted, who are at that point where their lives are in danger, anything we can do to help reduce the harm that they might face is good.
Those were sounds from our previous show,
The Pill of Death, The Fentanyl Crisis in America.
Find our back episodes online by searching LTAR Let's Talk About Race. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
You've been listening to LTAR Let's Talk About Race. We've been revisiting our show called Gun Violence, As American as Cherry Pie. The dilemma around gun violence that's faced in the United States is not an unsolvable one. It's not even one that has broad disagreement about steps to make it better. But it does chafe against the exchange of power between corporations, lobbyists, and lawmakers. These incentive structures allow the profits of the few to outweigh the good of the many. For LTAR, Let's Talk About Race, I'm Althea Billings.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by
Grassroot News Northwest. Catch previous episodes on Apple Podcasts or SoundCloud under LTAR or Let's Talk About Race. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio just wrapped up our annual fall membership drive. Support from listeners like you helped us reach our goal, gain new members, and prepared us to bring you more organic, homegrown, fresh off the vine community radio. Thanks to all those who donated during this drive, and thanks to those who listened in. Stay tuned for more.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre. A place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into Passing Sound, the first Saturday of each month at 10 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, or KBOO.FM, where we make musical structures for the listener to enjoy.